Okay, Bishop. I'd like to talk about the at least an introduction to the complex issue of Kedima Bikach Nefesh. In other words, how do we decide who needs to be saved? How we prioritize life saving when you cannot attend to or save all the lives who are in danger? This is a complex subject, and it ranges broadly across many areas of halacha. But in the time available, let me share with you a fascinating shaila that happened to arise in South Africa a few years ago, that is a very unusual opportunity to study the halachas of Kedima Bikach Nefesh, because it presents this question in a particularly fascinating way. Let's use that as a framework on which to build a concept of this area. For those who want to look up the references, there's a very detailed shiva on this in the Tzitz Eliezer in Yud Zayin Shiva Ayin Beis. There's a detailed Nedev Yehuda on one of the elements in the Tinyana in Resh Yud. There's Chasam Sofer on the same subject. There's a specific shiva on this South African question in Shivas Van Hagis. Tzitz Eliezer also talks about the South African situation. So plenty of references if you want to look up the detailed background. But let me fill you in on what the question was, and then we use that to try to build a picture. Here's the question. Now focus with me, because every detail is critical in understanding the evolution of the Indian. There was a young Jewish surgeon who was working in the hospital in Johannesburg, the big, known as the Johannesburg Hospital, which is a very large institution. In fact, the main building is 1 kilometer long. In the main corridor on the ground floor, you can see the curvature of the earth. And at one end of this big structure, they have a very advanced unit that they call the accident service. This is an advanced sort of a specialized casualty department that deals only with surgical trauma. Now, this happens to be a very busy unit. It has a very well-developed, well-known helicopter service, brings patients in from as far south as the Northern Cape. It's a very slick and well-organized unit. And this unit had acquired a new machine. Now, I wasn't there at the time. I'm not sure of the exact details of the technology, but it was some very advanced ventilator or ventilator resuscitator, something that could give a patient who's very badly injured the best possible chance of survival, prolonged survival. But the hospital issued a very peculiar instruction. The instruction was that no doctor on duty would be allowed to use this machine on any patient whom he considered to be non-salvageable. Okay, that means if there's a patient that is non-salvageable, what we would call broadly at this moment a chayei shah, somebody who could not survive, then they said, if this patient's inevitably about to die, he's going to die within hours or a day or two, you're forbidden to use the machine altogether. Why? You didn't expect me to do all the work there. No, cost wasn't an issue. Because they were concerned that if you committed the machine to the first patient, shortly thereafter another, they only had one, shortly thereafter another patient may arrive, who's a chaye olam, not the lashon they used in Afrikaans, but a patient who could survive, and you would have committed the machine to the first patient, and therefore not have it available for a person who could have lived, and this patient's going to die anyway. Therefore, hold the machine in abeyance, wait till the second patient comes in, and put it on the second patient that will survive. The objection to that, obviously, is why not simply put the first patient on the machine, wait until the second one arrives, if they arrive, take the first one off because they're going to die anyway, and put the second patient on and save their life. Why not? So that's not what the hospital said. The hospital said the reason we wouldn't allow that is because when you come to take the machine off the first patient, their family will object. And there'll be scenes of emotion and hysteria and chaos and all sorts of, you have to walk over and say, excuse me, your uncle's going to die. We need the machine for somebody else, we're switching it off. There'll be all sorts of pandemonium. They didn't want scenes like that. Don't get into that situation. Now, halakhically, that's completely invalid. The family's emotional response is not what governs the situation. But for the reason that some of you correctly said, we would agree with the output. And that is that you cannot switch off a ventilator on a patient who's dependent on it, because we consider that shirkos damim. If the patient's a treif, a certain type of treif, a treif b'de'odom, then it could be that it's not actionable in Sanhedrin, But nevertheless, it's shvichus damim. You cannot switch off a machine that a patient is dependent on. And if you rephrase the question in Jewish terms, it comes out to be this. If patients A on the machine, and they need it to survive, and patient B comes in who could survive and A cannot, you would not be allowed to switch off the machine. Ein doichen nefesh mipnei nefesh. You can't switch off the machine on A, even though they're going to die anyway, inevitably soon, to put it on B. And therefore, the question is valid from a Jewish point of view, even though the rationale that they use might not be. Now, this young Jewish surgeon added to the question the following detail. He said, not only is this situation the hospital describes a real issue, but it's so real that it's guaranteed. Yes, as well. In other words, this place is so busy that I can guarantee you statistically. Now, I'm not going to argue this morning about whether there is such a notion in halacha. Now, for now, we're going to accept that. I can guarantee you statistically that if you put patient A on the machine, who's going to die inevitably, there's a statistical guarantee that patient B, who's Jewish as well, will arrive during the time that the first patient's on the machine, and patient B will die because the machine will not be available and you'll not be allowed to switch it off on patient A. I'm not asking about the Sofek against the Vara here. That's another Shada. I'm talking about a Vara against the Vara. That means, are we clear? So if patient A, you're a trauma surgeon, 8 o'clock in the morning you come on duty, right? You sit there studying your Daf Yomi like all good trauma surgeons do. They come and bother you and tell you that a desperately badly injured patient is coming. You run over, you examine the patient, and you can tell in about a minute and a half, like all good doctors can do, exactly how long the patient is going to live. We never get that wrong. And and you can see this patient is going to live for exactly 3.5 hours, or one day, it's clear. Right? Whenever we analyze any halakha situation, we always pretend that all the variables are clear, right? We always do that because it's good old scientific method. You freeze all the variables artificially and move the one you're interested in and see what happens. Halacha always assumes that all the givens, except the one you're debating, are fixed. So if it's given and fixed that this patient will not live, and it's given and fixed that inevitably someone's going to come in who could have lived, then the hospital said, don't use the machine, wait for the second patient. And this young Jewish surgeon was concerned to know whether he was acting in accordance with the law. He went to ask one of the gedolim of this generation, happened to be in South Africa at the time. He went to ask him, am I obliged to obey the hospital's instruction, which means I'll have the machine and I'll be able to save a second life, or does Torah require me to use the machine, as it were, steal it against the hospital's instruction, give it to the first person because he's here now, and witness a second person die later because I won't be able to switch the machine off? But if I'm required to do that, then I will disobey the hospital's instruction, and I'll do that. It may mean disciplinary action. I might lose my license to practice. Who knows what it means? But I'll do that if it's necessary.
Is patient A also Jewish?
Let's deal now with two Jewish patients, or two non-Jewish patients for that matter. But I can assure you it's complicated enough without that. But let's try to take a brief look at the background to this question and analyze the elements that are involved and come back and see if we can try to apply them. First of all, you know that this question of triage is a very broad issue. After all, we're dealing with triage, right? Triage means, as I'm sure you're aware, the question of prioritizing who gets saved. The old First World War term that was coined when there were vast numbers of injured patients and you couldn't save all of them, you tried to divide them into three groups. Triage. The one group that would survive without you, the one that wasn't going to live anyway, no matter what you did, and you tried to target the third group that would die if you didn't treat them and might survive if you did. The problem of selection. And this is a very well-known, it's one of the major concerns in modern medicine with terrorist attacks and mass casualties and tragedies, how you prioritize the injured and know whether you're in all sorts of wrenching questions that come out of this. Recently someone in Israel asked one of the post-gim if you're allowed to walk over dying people, I mean walk on dying people, to get to somebody you could save, even though you might take a chance of extinguishing a life or somebody you trample on, all sorts of terrible questions like this. But triage protocols are very well known. In fact, unfortunately, it's fallen to the Israelis to have to lead some of this, some of the research in this area. And hospitals all over the world have triage protocols. If you walk into the Royal Free Hospital this morning with chest pain, the first thing you'll hear is triage, and an expert will come over immediately and examine you to decide how urgent your case is, so they can stratify you accordingly and give you what's necessary. If they decide you have an absolute emergency, you'll only have to wait until Tuesday. If they decide that it's just a regular emergency, then you only have to wait until November. But the point is that they triage patients to know how to give a stratification of the priorities so that they can use them appropriately. But this is a very broad issue. It's not only the question of stopping an accident where two people are bleeding and you have only one pair of hands. It's a much broader issue. Poskim discuss, for example, the question of if you run the hospital budget. You're not a doctor, but you're responsible for spend funds. Are you allowed to fund a new well baby clinic when you don't have enough intensive care beds? That's also a triage decision. At a political level, is a country allowed to spend money on its parks and museums when it doesn't have enough military or intensive care facilities? Also a triage decision. It's a very wide-ranging issue, and it has some fascinating details. The Gemara in Nedarim says, for example, that if you have two cities on a river, right? You have a river flowing, and you have one city upstream and another city downstream, and there's only enough water in the river that if the upstream people drink, the downstream people can drink as well. But if the upstream people drink and wash, then there's no water for the downstream people to drink at all. What's the chiyuv of the upstream people? Are they allowed to wash as well, leaving no drinking water for the downstream people who will die immediately? Or are they allowed to, are they constrained only to drink and leave water? Amazingly, after Machlekes, the conclusion, the Gemara is the upstream people drink and wash and leave no water for the downstream people. The Gemara says, why? Answer is because if they don't wash, you have an outbreak of illness, hygiene-related illness, whatever the name is. We don't understand whether it means cholera or typhus or whatever disease it is. But some disease will break out due to hygiene problems. And although they might not die as immediately as they would die at first, they'll die just as surely a couple of days later. They're allowed to factor that into their decision and deny the people downstream water. So they're very broad issues here, fascinating issues, all sorts of peculiarities. Just to show you how far it can go, in the Tanya a few years ago, somebody donated to Laniado Hospital, a wealthy American donated to Laniado Hospital a kidney dialysis machine on condition that it's only allowed to be used for tourists. Because he was concerned that an American in kidney failure who wants to visit as yourself cannot visit, because no one's going to dialyze him in a country that's overloaded with its own, you know, it hasn't have enough facilities for its own dialysis patients, and for that matter he wouldn't give up the slot in his home program. How's he going to visit? So what is, he'll visit Eretz Yisrael every two or three days on his tour. He'll pass through Netanya, he'll sleep overnight on dialysis, and between dialysis he'll fly back to the States. So they installed the machine, and you know what happens. As soon as the machine was installed, the person arrived in kidney failure was not a tourist. They went to the Klausenberg Rebbe and they said to him, what do we do? He said, Pekuach Nefesh, use the machine. Now the machine is fully used all the time. Don't ask me what would happen if a tourist and a non-tourist arrived at the same time. I have no idea. But this is a peculiar example of how facilities can get used with conditions. This is very... Let me give you one more introductory example. A couple in a certain European city a few years ago found themselves unable to have children. They ended up at a hospital in Tel Aviv, and they were able to have a child. The father happened to be particularly wealthy, and he made a massive donation to the hospital, specifying that it should go to the fertility unit to help other people have children. But this was an Israeli situation. And the director of the hospital said, we don't want your money for that, we've got more important needs. We need surgical intensive care beds, and Pekuach Nefesh comes before bringing people into the world. The man said, I'm not giving my money for that. They went to Rav Eliashiv. And I heard from Rav Zilberstein, his son-in-law, that Rav Eliashiv said he's fully entitled to give the money to the fertility unit. So the hospital director said, how does that take priority over Pekuach Nefesh? And Rav Eliashiv said, and you have to have very broad halakhic shoulders for this, he said, a country needs to be normal. And it does something to people's morale when you only fund emergency type facilities, and that's something that's serious to a country, and therefore he's entitled to give his money for it. I'm not sure he would have said that if there was somebody immediately dying in front of us, yeah? But he wants to give his money to that. He's fully entitled to do that. So you get all sorts of situations that are require triage type of thinking. Let's focus for a few minutes on the immediate issues in triage and see if we can prioritize the principles that are involved. Let's say I walk into a room and there are two people dying. Here's one and here's another, let's say. I walk into the room. What's the first criterion I apply in deciding which one to take? I can only save one, right? In 10 minutes they're both going to have died, and I can only stop the bleeding in one of them. How do I decide? What's the first principle I use in halacha to decide which one to save? Who's what? That's an interesting thought, and I'll come back to that. He's referring to Hurius, right? Sugyan Hurius, our young Talmudot, who says that what we do is, that's a very good suggestion, who is bigger Talmud Chacham? Who's greater, right? I'll try and show you why it's not relevant here. What? Closer meaning? The one is physically closer, yes. The first priority is, I treat this patient first because I'm in proximity, he's closer to me, before going to the more distant patient. The reason for that is, Ein ma'avirin ala mitzvah. You're not allowed to bypass the mitzvah, and therefore two equal mitzvahs, if I start from here, I have to treat the patient. But I can't bypass this mitzvah because nefesh to get to an equivalent, more distant mitzvah. And therefore, the first person comes in, your question, your point about who's greater, was raised in a fascinating example. In 1948 or 49, there were 8 children in Hadassah with meningitis, and there was only enough penicillin for 2. Now, in those days, meningitis was almost universally lethal, and the penicillin was all virtually guaranteed cure. The doctors didn't know which two children to give the penicillin to, and they went to ask Rabbi Herzog, the chief rabbi of Israel at the time, how do we choose which two children to give the penicillin? I heard some fun with Moshe Feinstein, and I heard from somebody who was present, the conversation took 15 seconds. And Moshe said, tell them to walk in and give it to the first two beds they come to. So Herzog said, what about the Sugyan Harius that says first Talmid Chacham, or a boy before a girl, or girls before boys? Whole discussion, who, in fact, he said, Moshe said, it's not Shaykh here. You walk into the ward, the first two children get the medicine, and then you run out and you can't save the others. So Ein Ma'avirin would be the first principle, and it takes precedence even over those considerations. Let's say you walk in from here. So both patients are equidistant. One's your brother and one's a stranger. Who comes first? Your brother comes first. Why? Because your mum will be upset? Why did your brother come first? Because you have mitzocha al tisalem, right? Mitzocha al tisalem, you're not allowed to ignore your flesh. Many poskim say it means a neighbor as well, or someone you have a relationship with, even a friend it could be, but certainly a relative. You are not allowed to, you have to prioritize the relative. It gets complicated when you are working in a paid position where you paid, where there's condition in the employment, for example, in a government hospital where you, of course, cannot prioritize relatives. It gets more complicated. There are broad issues there. But all else being equal, you have to treat Mitzvah HaTisalem before you treat the motive. Now, what's the next question I must ask you? What am I going to ask you next? What? Where? Yeah, the obvious question is going to be, what happens when my brother is more distant? Which priority takes priority? What happens if this is a stranger but he's closer to me? Am I overall and my ability to get to my brother because of himself as Yisalem or not? Which priority comes first? No?
You said that the end my ability took priority over the various state of.
Yes, that's right. Does it take priority over himself as Yisalem? Yes, this is.
It's only after that,
but the question is why. The halacha is like this: that mitzvah al tisalem takes precedence over ein ma'avirin. You walk past the ein ma'avirin to get the mitzvah al tisalem, and since we don't have enough time now for homework, try to figure out why. They're both derived from derivatives. They're both not so simple to interesting exercise. Why do you ignore the ein ma'avirin in order to get them himself at his time? So interesting exercise, but that's correct, that's what you do. Now, of course there are many permutations here. Which relatives take precedence over which relatives? Father before mother, mother father, Rebbe father. There are many other issues here, but let's move on to what's a bit more close to our question. Let's say you walk into a room from here, both are equidistant, both are equally related or unrelated. One's a chayeh olam and one's a chayeh shah. A chayeh shah in halacha means somebody who would not live for a year. Rav Chaim Weizer has a tshuva in which he discusses somebody who will not live for 6 months. And Rav Moshe says it just happened to be that in that case it was a 6 month survival, but the concept is more than a year. Not without going to the derivation now. So let's say you have somebody who could not survive for a year, chayeh shah. Here we're talking about people who are going to survive much less than that, but without getting into the problems of a geiseh, but somebody who is a chayeh shah and somebody who is a chayeh olam. In other words, both of them are endangered now. Let's say they've had an accident, both are bleeding. In 10 minutes, neither one will be alive. But one has no other problem besides the bleeding, and the other one has a longer-term serious problem that will cause their demise within 3 months or 6 months, let's say. Which one do you say first?
The old rules.
No, I didn't. You're adding a new complication. Sorry. Neither one's further away. The only difference is one can survive, one cannot. One's going to live inevitably, long term, if you save them. The other one cannot survive for hours.
Your business too. who's going to live longer?
It certainly is, absolutely. This is what the Americans call a no-brainer. Right? If you have somebody you can live long-term, and somebody's going to die within an hour, and you can save the Chayei Olam, there's clear obligation to save the Chayei Olam. Definitely. If they're equidistant, nothing else between them, I know it's bothering you, we'll come to your problem in a moment. But if all else equal, you save the Chayei Olam, and you ignore the Chayei Shoah. Now the obvious problem is what's being raised here, what if the Chayei Shoah is closer? Now you have an obligation to treat the Chayei Shoah. We're not talking about somebody you don't treat anyway, I'm not talking about that. Talking about a Chayei Shoah that you treat, that you need to treat in the short term. For example, somebody who's inevitably terminal but wants to be treated in the short term, even if they're suffering. So Moshe Feinstein says that if a person wants to prolong their temporary life, even if they're suffering, you mechuyav to continue. So let's say I have a Chayei Shoah who's closer, and I have to walk past him to get to a Chayei Olam. Are you doing the end ma'avirin in this case? Answer is yes. The Chayei Olam takes precedence over the end ma'avirin for the same logic we used before, while we didn't go into it. And you walk past the Chayei Shoah to get to the Chayei Olam. Now, that's clearly what you do in order to save the Chayei. Now, here comes the complication, and here's where the Navi Yehuda comes in, and this is a point that is often not understood correctly, and it's a source of much debate in the poskim. And that's what I'd like to focus on now, and that's this. Whenever you walk past an obligation, whenever a chiyuv, for example, you break Shabbos to save a life, or you do a post mortem, which is breaking three deraisas, not potentially, in order to save a life, right? You know, you do a post-mortem, you are transgressing potentially three deraisas. One, hanah from a mace you may not have if you take part of the body. Two is a chiyuv to bury all of the mace, you may not do that if you take it part. And three is nivul mace, you're dissecting the body, disfiguring the human body. Some poskim say it applies to non-Jewish bodies too, because the inyan is tzelem elokim, and the human body is tzelem elokim. It's not shaykh, it doesn't matter if it's Jew or not. The maskon is we don't hold like that. Other poskim say it's covered ames, which means that the mace can give permission. The person can give permission before he dies because it's covered ames. But be that as it may, you're not allowed to do a postmortem. Now, obviously, you do a postmortem to save a life, right? Because you do almost everything in the Torah to save a life. But the question is like this: says Navi Huda, you have to show me the life you intend to save. What the Navi Huda calls is a chole lefanenu. This is the most important overriding principle in Pikuach Nefesh. Is that whenever you wish to save a life, and it involves putting aside the halacha, for example, breaking Shabbos, doing a post-mortem, anything like that, the condition is, show me the life. You want to be doicha Shabbos, or some other priority, show me the life you want to save now. Not a life that may be saved in the future. Information that may save lives. That's below the red line, although there's a big argument about this. But the clearest, the native Yehuda's tshuva is on a question that was sent to him from London. There were some doctors in London who had a patient who died. He had a problem with his bladder, and they wanted to know how to do the surgery next time to be able to save a life like this. So they wrote to Navi Huda, who was in Prague at the time, 1780, 1790, somewhere around there, and they asked him, can we do a post-mortem on this individual to know how to save lives in the future? And a very detailed tshuva, the Navi Huda says, show me the life you want to save. There must be someone else like that now. Yeah, because then you can talk about Pikuach Nefesh. But getting information that may save lives in the future, that not. And this is an absolute criterion in terms of breaking Shabbos and in terms of research, medical research on bodies and postmortems and all sorts of issues like that. You need the question of a chole lefanenu. Now, the question we need to focus on for just a few moments is this. What's called lefanenu? Does it mean the same room, the same hospital, the same city? What's the concept of lefanenu? Well, it's very clear from the Navi Yehuda that what we mean is not geographical distance. We mean a real identified person. The fact that he's physically closer or further is not the issue. For example, the poskim today apply this criterion in organ transplantation. The way organ transplantation works in England today and in America and South Africa and Australia, many places, there's a national computerized matching program. There are hundreds of people waiting for kidneys, and they are ranked on a computerized program that ranks the priority of the person according to his need and antigenic matching with the organs that become available. So when organs are taken, for example, in a hospital today, the doctors taking the kidneys today don't know who's going to get them in 6 hours' time. It may be a patient in Birmingham. But that's called lefanenu, because there's a real name on a list, a real extant patient right now who's going to get the kidney. The fact that he may not be here now physically, or even the fact that I don't know his name, is not the issue. And I think you can see the scorer behind that. Give you an extreme example. 1986. There was a baby born in California with heart disease. The child was dying, and there was no hope for the child but a heart transplant. Yeah. Now, 1986 was very early in the days of heart transplant, without going to our halachas of transplantation, whether it's mutter or not. But the surgeon happened to be Jewish, a doctor by the name of Norman Shumway, and he decided for the first time in history to attempt a transplant into a newborn. Yeah, let me remind you that heart transplantation only began in 1967 in a particular country. We don't need to go into that. And it was in 1986 that he decided for the first time to transplant a heart into a baby. The problem was, where do you find a heart? They scoured the entire United States and they found a baby available for being a donor in Vermont. Vermont's 3,000 miles away from California, but they had no other option, so they hired a private jet. They put one of the young surgeons on the team into this jet and they flew him across the country to Vermont. He cut out the heart of the child in Vermont and put it into a box of cold cardioplegic solution, and they couldn't get the jet to start. They ended up scrambling United States Air Force supersonic fighter, put a terrified young doctor in the back of a supersonic fighter with a heart in a box on his lap. When they got back to California, they had to resuscitate the surgeon, but they did, and they saved the life of the baby in California, and that halachic is called the fanelu. The 6,000 miles is not the issue, right? There was a real child who needed to be saved. His geographical distance is not the issue, and therefore, that's what they did. Now, let's come back to our case and appreciate the fascination of our particular case. What's our problem? Our problem is, we have a patient who is injured, who's not going to survive, right? We have a machine, here's the machine, here's our patient. Our patient's a chayesho, is only going to live for an hour. If I put the machine on the patient, he's going to live for longer, to give him a better chance, right? But I know there's someone coming in later, you hear the problem. Now let's apply what we've learned this morning and see if we can work it out. Let's get the scenario clear. 8 o'clock in the morning, I'm a trauma surgeon, I come on duty, they call me over, I examine my patient, and I see he's clearly a chayesho. I have a machine next to me, which could give him a better chance to prolong his life, right? I'm about to put the machine on, when suddenly I look up and I see the door opening. And I see they're wheeling in a chayesho. This is a chayesho, that's a chayesho. This one's closer, but he's going to survive. Do I wait until he gets here and give him the machine? Or do I give it to the closer patient?
Wait.
I wait. It's from the door to here called Lefanenu? Yeah. No questions. Absolutely. Good. Scenario number two. 8 o'clock in the morning, desperately injured patient, about to put the machine on, the phone rings. On the phone, they tell me the ambulance is on its way. In the ambulance, 10 miles away, is a desperately injured patient who's potentially a Chayrelam. Do I wait?
Yes. Yes.
Is 10 miles Lefanenu?
Yes.
Yes.
Number three. Desperately, you're doing great. Desperately injured patient, not going to survive, about to put the machine on. As I'm about to put the machine on, the radio crackles to life. On the radio, they tell me that in a helicopter 150 miles away is a Chaye Olam. An hour and a half from now, he'll be here. Do I wait?
Yes.
150 miles Lefanenu?
Yes.
Okay, now listen carefully, very carefully. 8 o'clock in the morning, I have this desperately injured patient. I'm about to put the machine on. No disturbance, no phone call, no radio call. But there's a statistical guarantee that someone's going to be here in an hour. Is a statistical Lefanenu?
No. No.
Ooh, you have to be very, very sharp to answer that fast. See, the question is, I think you can make a hakir here. The question is like this. Normally in a Lefanenu, we have two issues conflated. Namely, a person present and a life whom we'll save. It's the same person. In our peculiar case, we have separated them. We don't have somebody present. But we certainly think about it for a moment. If you put the machine on the first person arguing that no one else is here, 2 hours from now somebody's going to die. Where is that person? Right now he's fine. He's having breakfast with his wife, mumbling at her from behind the newspaper, not realizing that an hour from now he's going to run into a truck on the highway on his way to work, but he is. Min Shemaya, as it were, they're looking down and they're saying, you are in trouble today. So he's not Lefanenu because he's not a patient yet. But in an hour or two from now, given that there's a statistical guarantee, somebody's going to be here, could have been saved, and that person's going to die. What's the inyan of Lefanenu? Is it the fact that the person's present? Or is it the fact that we're anxious to save a life as opposed to a life that cannot be saved? Let me tell you what happened, and I'll stop. I don't know if we're allowed to go over time for questions or not. Let me summarize what happened in this particular case, and I'll stop for questions if there are any that I'm capable of answering. What happened was like this. The person who was asked in South Africa answered this young doctor that the hospital is correct. You should obey the instruction. Hold off on the machine. You don't have to risk your position and your salary, etc. Hold off on the machine. Allow the first person to do your best with older technology. If they die, they die. And have the machine held over for the second person who arrived later. But he then sent the shaila to one of the world famous poskim in Yerushalayim at the time, who, just out of interest, not the doctor of course, he was given his psak, but the poskim himself sent it on, and that answer was that the hospital is incorrect. That's not called the Fadeiru. That's not, yeah, and this is, it goes into a whole debate about exactly what the criteria are, but he felt that that's not correct, and therefore you would be obliged to use the machine for the presentation. And then they sent the question to Rav Zilberstein as well, who had a completely different answer, right? To this very clear yes or no question, there were three completely different answers. What was his answer? That's one, and I usually use this for doctors who are beginning in the pathway in Yiddishkeit to show them how you can have such variant answers to the same shaila based on a hair's breadth of logic, of sfora, of judgment about a particular matter. But his answer was like this. He said both approaches are wrong. Here's what you do. You take your newfangled machine and you attach to it a clock and a bell. And this is what you do. As soon as the first patient arrives, you immediately put the machine on them and set it running. Half an hour later, it rings the bell to warn you and switches off. Nurse walks over and switches it on again immediately. Carries on ventilating the patient for another half hour. Half an hour later, it rings the bell to warn you again, switches off, and you walk over and reset it. You keep doing that until the second person arrives. When the second person arrives, you wait until the machine switches off. And instead of restarting it on the first, you restart it on the second. Now, whether the Johannesburg Hospital would like Shabbos clocks on its ventilators, I don't know. But this is what he suggested. And in fact, I had the privilege of speaking to the ethics committee at Columbia University a few months ago, and they told me that they are now considering putting their intensive care ventilators on clocks and on timers, so that they will not be disposed to not put someone on a ventilator for fear that they may not wean them off the ventilator. Now they'll put them on the ventilators, and if they get to a situation that's inevitably terminal, they'll simply let the machine switch itself off and use the machine for other people. This is not simple at all halakhically, but that is now being seriously contemplated in, as you can imagine, Columbia University's ethics committee is virtually all Jewish, and this is what they are now considering, and this is becoming a real issue. Are there any questions that I can deal with? If so, I'm happy to.
If all things are equal, how do you decide?
If that's a very, yes, if all things are equal, it makes absolutely no difference. Just get to one of them and save it.
Is the Jewish
life
always ahead of?
Well, in terms of today's discussion, he's at least a Mitzvah Al Tisalim, right? At least. Whereas a non-Jew is not.
And if Chayyim Shul Chayyim?
Then ask me afterwards.
How can you have a case of